The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. I'm joined today by three guests from our SALT practice group at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm, Mr. Tim Noonan, Mr. Andrew Wright, and Ms. Emma Savino. Everybody, thanks for joining me today.
All right, Joe. Thanks.
Morning, Joe.
We're going to be discussing a landmark new decision in the world of tax law, the matter of Obis case, which has dramatically shifted the foundation of New York's statutory residency test, specifically with respect to the permanent place of abode prong. Anybody who's a tax professional knows about the statutory residency test. But for those of you who are not tax professionals who are listening, it is a test where you can be deemed a tax resident of New York State, where you both spend more than 183 days in the state and this is important to the discussion, maintain a permanent place of abode in the state during that taxable year. So we're going to be discussing how this new decision has shifted the framework for that permanent place of abode prong. But before we get into the current Obis decision, we need to talk about how we got here. And to give a little bit of background on the vacation home saga, as he called it in his recent Tax Note State article, Tim Noonan is going to talk a little bit about the couple of cases that got us to the point where we are at today. So, Tim, let's start with, I believe Barker comes first in this trilogy, correct?
Yeah, Barker's the first case. It's a case that we handled back in, 2010 or 2011, or long time ago. And, you know, the backdrop, Joe, is that this, you know, as we talked about in episode 3 of the State Tax Talks podcast series on residency, there's two residency tests. One is sort of the subjective, where your home is, and the statutory test is, you know, sort of historically this more objective test, right? If you got a place here and you spend too many days here, you're a resident. So the Barker case comes along, and he lived in Connecticut, so that was his home, and worked in New York City. So he was always going to be over the 183-day test, but he didn't have an apartment in the city. He just, you know, commuted in and out every day like tens of thousands of people at least used to do before COVID. But he had a vacation home in the Hamptons, just kind of like a crappy 1,100-square-foot cottage, like not a palatial estate or something. And they like barely used it. They had a bunch of little kids and were super busy, and he let his in-laws stay there a lot. They were there like 2 weeks a year. But the state was like, oh, sorry, objective test. You got too many days here. You have a place here. And that vacation house is a permanent place of abode. It's sort of objectively speaking, it, you know, you could stay there. You know, you wouldn't die if you slept there. We sort of tried to argue it wasn't like a suitable place for full-time usage. And really, it just wasn't used by the guy as a residence, right? So, yeah, so that was the first case that we unceremoniously lost back in 2011. But I do remember in getting ready for it and going through the research, like, it looked to us, Jack Trachtenberg was an associate of mine way back when, and we were like, man, it kind of looks like there's a subjective aspect to this too. You look at sort of like the legislative history, which said, hey, we're putting this test in to tax people who like really live here, who really are residents. And there was some case law that said, we got to look at like what the place is like. So we made that argument, but the court, the tax appeals tribunal in that case said, nah, you know, doesn't matter. You know, you could stay there. We don't care that you didn't stay there. And the guy lost. So that was the Barker case.
So we start off the saga with an unceremonious defeat, unfortunately. But this issue doesn't really go away. There's more of the story to be told, because it just seems like, to those tax professionals out there, that the way that this test is being interpreted by the tax department and by the New York State courts is incorrect. It's too narrow. It's too mechanical for just, oh, it can't be as simple as just you have access to a place. So Barker finishes, and then how do we get to Gayed?
You say Gaiad, I say Gaiad. That's fine.
There we
That's
go.
Fine. Yeah.
How much time did you give to him, by the way?
I'm actually not familiar with the Gaiad case. Drew, can you tell us a little bit about it? I get grief for bringing that case up because I try not to talk about the Barker case because, you know, I lost. But the Gaiad case, we won. And it's so we took the Gaiad case around the same time Barker was kind of percolating. That wasn't a vacation home case, but it was basically another case that was around whether or not someone's place was a permanent place of abode. And he had a place for his folks. He was in over the, you know, 183 days. He commuted in for work from Jersey every day, but had a place for his folks. He didn't live there. It was his place. He owned it. He paid all the bills. And we kind of made the same argument, like, hey, you know, it's got to be your place. Well, that case worked its way up actually all the way to New York's highest court. And New York's highest court actually said, yeah, you know what? That legislative history stuff about you really got to live there, you know, they bought into that. The court agreed. So, I mean, it was one of the first residency cases to get to the highest court in like decades and decades. And the court was like, yeah, we do think there's a subjective aspect to this. The court in that case called it a residential interest. You got to have like a residential interest, but basically you got to use it as a residence. So that was 2014. And it was, you know, sort of not a direct repudiation of Barker, but it kind of was. I mean, it's sort of that analysis sort of turned Barker on its head. So that was 2014.
Right. And thus the legend of Tim Noonan was born.
Yes.
And for fans of magic, that's how Tim spins a loss into a win.
Totally. True. You didn't even see it. It was seamless.
But you didn't get your full Barker retribution yet. Not until we get to Obis and you are eventually proven correct. For the listeners out there, there is a history behind this case that we just discussed that started transforming what was a purely mechanical test into this more subjective test. And I think that legislative history aspect that they talk about in both Gaiad and as well as Obis, that the underlying intent of tax law section 605 is to, quote, discourage tax evasion by residents of this state. I think that really, you know, kind of broadens how you have to interpret this, because that's hyper specific. Like, that is looking for a very particular type of person or a class of person, as they used in the Obis decision. And I think that in the end is kind of what blows the lid off this thing.
Yeah. And just like, I don't know if one of you guys want to take up like why it's important. Like, who cares whether it's a permanent place of abode or not? It does, because you're like a resident of another state. So like, Drew, what happens then when you have your resident of two states? Like, taxpayers get screwed, right?
Yeah. I mean, it becomes super important, right? Because if I'm domiciled in one state and a statutory resident of New York, then geez, I might have a double taxation issue. And the legislative history is interesting. I mean, I think the sort of memo that we cited as support for the legislative history in Gaiad was from like the 1920s or something, right? So
right.
Super old legislative history. But what it says at root, right, is we want to tax people who are really residents here, right? Even if I claim to live somewhere else, right, I claim domicile somewhere else, I've got a driver's license, whatever it is, if I'm really living in New York, I should be taxed as a resident. And so the legislative history was basically saying we're going after people who are residents, right, people who really live in New York. And it's become sort of difficult to square that with how they audit statutory residency in practice, right? I mean, this was all sort of really old law before New York had the kind of audit program they have now. But to me, that's what it says, right? We're really looking for people who are residents, even if you claim domicile elsewhere. Now, when they audit those people, if I really sort of live in New York, they're just going to say I'm domiciled here, right, before they ever get to statutory residence.
Interesting. And of course, you know, the risk of double taxation is the single greatest evil that all taxpayers fear, that we are courageously fighting against at all times.
Yeah, well, and the funny part, right? I mean, you look at the, you know, the Gaiads and the Obises of the world, they might not have had a huge risk of double taxation, right? New Jersey residents, it's almost like they're taking up the moral mantle, but it's certainly a risk for lots of people.
And we'll talk more about this concept of the class of people that this is kind of supposed to be targeting later in our kind of where do we go from here section. But I think this is a good time to transition into the discussion of Obis itself. And I'm going to turn it to Emma to give some details on what happened in this case. You know, what was the background and what does Obis stand for?
So Nelson Obis, again, lived in New Jersey. He worked in New York City, and he had this vacation home that was in Northville, New York. It was nowhere near, you know, his office. It was 200 miles away, but it was a substantial place. Like, it was had 5 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and it was, you know, climate controlled so it could be used year round. So it wasn't, you know, just a cottage that didn't have heat and could only be used seasonally. The other thing that kind of went on here is he did have this separate apartment that was used year-round by a guy he rented it to for a pretty nominal amount. But there was this other person who lived there year-round, and Obis, he had to give him notice. Well, he didn't have to, but he always did give him notice if he was going to be coming up for a period of time. And he really didn't use this place that much. He would go up, you know, maybe a week or two a year, and that was both during the winter and during the summer. I guess he used it as like a ski place and also as a place where he'd go see horse racing, I believe. He didn't really keep anything there, which I think is also important. You know, everything that they needed, they brought up for the week or two when they were up there. So that's kind of like the background of the facts of the place. And it was, you know, not at issue that he spent more than 183 days in the city here. This was only about whether this place qualified as a permanent place of abode because, you know, he was working in the city. So during these years, you know, when people were actually going into the office, he was well over the threshold.
Right. And this is a set of facts that, like, we've seen before. I mean, prior to Obis, somebody who came to us with this set of facts, it would have been, well, let's really look to see if you're over 183 days, not, well, is this really a PPA? So a lot of taxpayers in Mr. Obis's situation were out of luck prior to this decision. But he swung some legal magic, didn't he, Emma? Because he wins.
Eventually. He did lose a couple of times, though. He lost at the ALJ level, and then he lost again at the tribunal level. It was only when he got to the appellate division that he finally got the W here.
So he has to take this case all the way out of the administrative system, get away from the auditors, get away from, you know, dealing with judges who are typically just looking at tax cases, and get it into the hands of the lovely justices over at the Third Department. And now we get into a question of statutory interpretation, every lawyer's favorite thing. Let's read the words on the page and then discuss what they mean outside of, you know, just the words on the page.
Yeah, and if you read the tribunal's decision, which obviously ultimately got overturned, it kind of reads like a recitation of conversations that, you know, we've all had with auditors over the years, right? They say things like, the taxpayer had the right to reside in the place. He maintained living arrangements at it. He exercised that right, even if sparingly. He had free and continuous access. We've had those conversations time and again with auditors where we have effectively what is limited use of a place, and we're saying, look, this isn't enough. This isn't a residential interest in the place. And they sort of kick this kind of analysis back at us and say it's access plus use, even occasional use, right?
But shockingly, auditors aren't wowed by 1922 legislative history. It just doesn't do it for them.
It's like an interesting sidebar question, right? But you think about this, and it's what do you make of like taxpayer losses at the audit level, at the administrative appeal level, in cases like Barker and Gayet and Obis, and then geez, we have to take it all the way to state court to get reprieve. Like, does that message get sent to the tax department, or are they gonna continue to just construe these things as narrowly as they can?
The latter. I mean, yeah. You know, and most people give up. Like, it's, you know, the Obis, you know, saga was probably 6 years in the making or something. Like, it just takes forever. It's expensive. So, you know, you really got to have the gumption to fight.
And I think the holding of this case will hopefully give taxpayers some more ammunition at their disposal to make an argument, because as Drew mentioned, that access plus use standard that we were dealing with prior to this decision, or as the tribunal worded it, quote, petitioners had the right to reside in and maintain living arrangements at the home and exercise that right during the years at issue. I mean, that's very mechanical. I mean, that is, it has a significant disregard for this intention behind, like, are we targeting the right class of people that this law is supposed to be kind of protecting? You know, we're trying to protect against tax evasion. And now we get into this new standard, which is, you know, this, it took residential interest, I think, a step further and broadened it and says all of a sudden, okay, now we need to have a fact-intensive analysis of the nature of the taxpayer's use and kind of the duration of their use at the same time. This is totally different from what we were looking at previously. I mean, this is subjective now. The nature of a taxpayer's use is just so broad, and we only have one example in Obis, right? Like, we have a vacation home that was used for skiing and visiting the Saratoga racetracks. How many other examples are potentially out there of a nature that doesn't qualify for maintaining a permanent place of abode could there possibly be? And now we're at the point of, like, where do we go from here? I think this is the interesting portion of this discussion.
Right. Well, then I think, you know, what did the court say? Like, what were some of the factors? Was 3 hours from where he worked, right? Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Not within commuting distance, right? 3 to 4 hours from his office in the city, only 2 to 3 weeks of use over the entire year. You know, the visits there were to go to the, you know, ski or to the racetrack or to do cross country skiing, and didn't keep any of their personal effects there.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is kind of weird. Didn't keep any stuff there. Like,
but it was furnished. So it's like, what are they doing? Just bringing a backpack of clothes with them?
Yeah, like you would with any vacation home that, like, you know, you don't spend a lot of time.
Right? Yeah.
And which immediately I'm like, okay, well, what if I just left, like, a couple old, like, sweaters there that, like, I wore that, like, at night? Like, where's, and I think this is what's interesting about that it's subjective now, is there's a lot of room for interpretation. If I'm a commuter and I read this case, I'm like, sweet. This is what I've been waiting for. I got my vacation place in New York. It has nothing to do with, like, my work. You know, it's not in the city, and I commute to New York for work because a ton of people do that live in Connecticut, that live in New Jersey. And all of a sudden I feel like I'm probably going to call up a tax professional and be like, can we make sure that, like, I'm good and I can start spending, you know, 250 days in New York all of a sudden? I mean, it's going to change lifestyles for a lot of people, which, of course, you have to be careful, because if your lifestyle changes too much and you end up domiciled in the state, that's, you know, a whole separate problem.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing people are doing is calling up their tax professionals and wondering, am I going to get a refund? Like, they've been paying tax under the sort of Barker rule for the past bunch of years. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, wait, Obis came out. So potentially refunds down the line too.
Yeah. I mean, and it poses a broader question of, you know, look, this is an important decision, but how earth shattering is this really? I've certainly gotten lots of calls and emails over the last 6 months about, hey, I read this case. How does it impact my situation? And for the vast majority of folks who are sending those emails, the answer is it doesn't, right? Like, it has no impact on domicile. If you're someone who has a place in New York and you use it very regularly, it has, I don't think, any real impact on you. There's a category of folks, right? The vacation place folks, you know, you got a place upstate or in the Finger Lakes. You look like Obis. You got a place out in the Hamptons. You look like Barker. It's going to impact those folks for sure, right? So if I have a rarely used vacation place and I have to spend a lot of time in the city for work, and now I just want to relax on my day count, okay, maybe this gives you an avenue to have some comfort in doing that. And then I think there's a second category of taxpayers, which I think is going to be more common, which is, I maintain a place in the city. I live in New Jersey. I live in Connecticut. I live on Long Island. But I maintain a place in the city. And I'm in the city all the time because I work there, but I commute in and out almost every day. I never really stay there, right? It's used 3, 5, 10, 15 times a year. That happens all the time. I mean, we had a case come up right after Gate came out that had those facts. Emma and I have a case at audit right now that has those facts. And I think we'll see that a lot more. And, you know, it gets back to the question I posed to Tim a few minutes ago. What is the tax department going to say about those facts, right? Because, geez, those facts are different than Obis, right? It's not a vacation home upstate. It's a place in the city where I'm going for work.
Right. I think the number of hypotheticals that we could spout off are probably infinite at this point, based on kind of where things stand right now. I also, in reading the case myself, I question what the order of the analysis is. Is it, you know, if you are not maintaining a PPA in this specific way where, or if you're not maintaining a dwelling rather, where it doesn't constitute a PPA, are you therefore not in the class of people that this law was designed to target? Or is there a separate analysis of this person's not in the class of people at all because they're a commuter, they're not domiciled, and then you don't even need to get to the question of whether it's a PPA. I think there's left it a little bit open.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's the latter. Like who are the target class of taxpayers, I think, is a wave to the legislative history and trying to tax people who, you know, really are residents. That's what the legislative history said. I mean, look, you know, there might not be a lot of guesswork though, because there's just an article in Law 360 this morning indicating that the tax department, usually when the tax department gets contacted, they're like, oh, you know, no comment, yada, yada. They were like, yeah, we're going to come out with some, you know, sort of guidance on how this impacts or how this affects vacation home cases soon. Like, it was pretty sort of specific. So if history is any guide, they're going to come out and be like, yeah, it only applies to vacation homes in northern New York where someone stays there 15 times a year and doesn't keep stuff there. Like, they're going to be a super narrow interpretation of what it means. It's just kind of how they do it. I remember a case years ago, it was a sales tax case, and whether or not like the company had nexus in New York and had to pay taxes in New York, they had enough connection. And we had like a case right on point where the taxpayer like did the same exact thing as our guy. And we were like, so clearly we don't have nexus. And I was like, well, that's a different case. What do you mean? Like, we're a trucking company and we do the same things that the guys in that case did. And he was like, well, that was a tractor case. Like, so it's sort of like, we always talk about like, that's the taxpayer. We'll say, that's a tractor case. Like, who cares if it was a tractor or a truck? It doesn't matter. It's, you know, that's not a distinguishing factor, but they always try to kind of limit the scope of a decision to, you know, as narrowly as possible. So I suspect we're going to see something like that.
And that's not inconsistent with what they did after GEAD, right? I mean, they dropped, I think, the following year, updated audit guidelines that had a couple sections sort of specific to the GEAD case. And that's what they did there, right? They tried to limit the application of GEAD to its facts and—
Or worse. I mean, yeah, I thought they tried to sort of, you know, undermine it a bit in their analysis, but they definitely tried to put a lot of shade on it.
Yeah. The article you saw today said they're going to come out with guidance. No sort of indication that they're going to petition the legislature to change the law.
Didn't see that. No. Yeah. No,
because I mean, that would be the route for them to go, right? If they think, look, the legislative history is 100 years old, it's inconsistent with how we want the law to be applied, you need to go change the law.
Easy peasy. That's all they have to do.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder whether, just based on how many people we know to be leaving the state, whether there will be an appetite at the legislative level for a law change like that, because, you know, they're already, you know, kind of bleeding taxpayers, and they could lose a lot more theoretically under this new standard.
Although it needs the money, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but this is a tax on people who live somewhere else.
Yes. Right?
So the actual—
And people, they can't vote here.
Yes. The actual people you're screwing over are people who don't vote. But there are people who buy like vacation homes and help the local economy in that respect. So yeah, it's a interesting sort of tough call as to what they're going to do. Now, after the Barker case, there was a lot of pushback from like real estate agents on Long Island, like in the Hamptons, like, what the heck? This is going to kill our business. Because the vibe that came out like in the press, which, you know, shocking, but sometimes what you read in the newspapers isn't right, or on the internet, was like, oh, any vacation homeowner is a resident. Like, no, that's actually not what the case says, but lots of people thought. So in any case, this couple legislators from across the state proposed legislation that said, well, if the place is more than 90 miles from the 90 miles or 50 miles.
Yeah, I think it was 90.
Yeah, 90 miles or 90 days. It was like a miles requirement and a days requirement. If you only used it for like 90 days and it was 60 or 90 miles from like where you were normally in New York at your place of work, then we're not going to count it as a PPA. Like, okay, like that, you know, that would exclude vacation homes. It wouldn't exclude New York City apartments that are rarely used like we have in some cases. But so that legislation, it was proposed a couple of times after that. Like, that would certainly allow the tax department to kind of put a Band-Aid over it.
Yeah.
And at least sort of give a wave to the Obis court rationale, but limit it to vacation home cases only.
One of the first things that popped into my head with respect to the New York City apartment issue is, well, what if I am not assigned to a New York office, but my company has an office in New York and I happen to have a New York City apartment. Like, that's not where I'm assigned to go to work. It's not my primary work location. I think that's an interesting question. But I'm sure an auditor would say, no, you can go in and use it. And it's like, okay, well, my name's not on the door. I have to ask permission. Like,
yeah, well, the idea that if you could use it, I mean, this is in the PPA analysis, not in the office analysis, but that if you could use it, then it's a PPA, like that's kind of over. Like,
yeah.
the OBIS rationale sort of says, well, no, you actually have to use it too. Gaia did too. Like, if you don't ever use a place, then who cares if it's available to you? You got to actually use it.
And to me, that unfettered access standard was just wildly broad. Like,
right.
Oh, you have a key, or you can get a key and get in, like PPA.
Yeah.
Boom.
Access. I mean, it was for a long time, access plus use, right? You have unfettered access and you make some use. And then it was like, well, what's use? And, you know, there was no standard for what was use, right? It's anything is use. And now we see GAED, we see OBIS, and certainly there has to be a minimum threshold, right? It's like, what's the sort of de minimis amount of days I can use it before I've used it as a resident sufficient to meet the test in GAED?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so, right? Otherwise, you're going to have people arguing like, oh, I only spent 5 months at my vacation home, but like those months were May, June, July, August, September. Like the weather was fantastic. Like we were literally, you know, we were in the Hamptons on the beach and it was vacationing. You know, I shouldn't be a New York resident. It's not a PPA.
Yeah, I wonder about those types of taxpayers that have a place in the Hamptons and like come into the city for work during the summer months. But so they're using their place for, you know, 3 to 4 months out of the year. Is that enough now all of a sudden because they are traveling to the city to go into work during the summer? Or are they going to be fine because, you know, it's still far enough from their work that we can say, yeah, this falls under the OBIS test?
I mean, are they going to lose that case because they have a toothbrush there? Like, I'm sure those folks have like stuff there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're also not within the target class of taxpayers that the folks in 1922 were trying to tax, right? They're like people who have a vacation home who spend the summer in the Hamptons. Like, that's not, those aren't people who really are residents.
I could argue they are though, right? It's like if you're spending 5 months a year effectively living in your place in New York State, right? Now you start to me to look like someone who could be in the target class of taxpayers, right? Okay, you're claiming domicile elsewhere, but you're spending, geez, almost half the year in your place in New York. You spend more than 183 days here.
What about 3 months?
That was my question.
Yeah. Yeah. Where do you draw the line, right? I mean, for now, at least when I talk to people, I'm drawing the line at 2 or 3 weeks, right? Because until we see how this case gets interpreted by the tax department, I mean, I think that's if they're going to be as aggressive as they can, that's where they're going to draw the line, right? We know this is not enough, but anything over that, we don't know that, right? That might be enough. So, you know, I think it's easy to draw the line there for now. How much more is allowed, you know, before you trip over the sort of legislative intent is a different question.
You know, there's going to be aggressive tax professionals out there who are going to be like, 4 months, like no problem. It's your vacation home. Just pack your backpack when you go there and pack your backpack when you leave and you're good. Not a PPA.
I think if you're under 100 days, you're in the ballgame, you know, because that's like, you know, Memorial Day to Labor Day sort of thing, like mm-hmm. that kind of usage, like that is like vacation-y. And if you're sort of in the vacation-y type usage land, like, you know, you're not within the target class of taxpayers. Like, that's like new lingo that we didn't have before the OBIS case. I love that. Like, that's a really good way to sort of encapsulate, like, what the test is supposed to get at, like, people who really live here. Even the GAED case didn't go that far. GAED case talked about residential interest.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is residential interest? Like, that was like a new standard. I mean, sort of we understood what the court was saying, you know, you got to use it as a residence, right? But I mean, I guess OBIS didn't use his place as a residence, right? Certainly not within the meaning of the sort of legislative history. But I mean, he did stay there a few weeks a year. But, you know, I think as you get more and more days, the idea of, you know, do you really live there, you know, becomes a little more harder to define.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gets into this weird distinction that, you know, it only affects a certain class of people, let alone a certain class of taxpayers of like, first of all, you got to have multiple homes. Second of all, you have to be between that distinction of, okay, are you someone who has two homes or three homes? Do you have a home and a vacation place? Do you have like a summer home and a winter home? And now you're getting into these questions of, you know, it's the analysis we do right a lot of time in domicile, like where's your primary residence on the home factor? Like some of that analysis may now come into the PPA analysis of like, well, let's look at whether this, you know, has the amenities and facilities of a primary residence. It's obviously not going to end there because look at how nice Nelson Obis's place was. It was a big house.
Well, and most importantly, putting all that aside, right, you have to be someone who spends more than 183 days in New York for any of this to matter, right? And so there, to your point, I think it is, it's a relatively small class of taxpayer who this affects, but it's an important class, right, in terms mm-hmm. of the tax dollars that are at stake. But to me, right, it's like putting all this aside and the arguments that we can make, right? The easiest way to avoid statutory residency is always going to be to spend less than 183 days in New York, right? Mm-hmm. That's just that will remain a purely objective part of the test, even if there's subjectivity in this other part.
Yeah. I mean, that's the next frontier. Like battling like what really counts as a day. And if you come in to get a root canal, like is that, and that puts you one day over. Like, is that, like, should that count as a day? I mean, could be the next frontier.
I'm totally with you on that. I think this whole 1 minute counts as a day BS is exactly that. Like, I just, there's some days that to me are like, they're not really days. They're days in the barest legal sense only for purposes of this test, and it should be disputed.
Yeah, and there's a whole category. We have a bunch of cases where sort of folks live in Greenwich. And actually, we had some vacation home cases where live in Greenwich, work in the city, don't go to work more than 183 days in the office, use the vacation home a month or so a year. So they're under the day count, except on Saturdays, they go to the Costco, like right over the border that happens to be in New York, or their kids got a soccer game against the school that's 5 minutes away in New York. They go get a sandwich in New York, like that's a day. And, you know, maybe 20 years ago, like unless you use your credit card or something, like, you know, the state would know that you spent that, you know, you went to get a sandwich. But now with cell phones, man, like that's pinging in New York. Like, mm-hmm. what are you going to say? And like, is that within the target class of taxpayers who are residents, yeah. who people who just by virtue of living close to the border spend over 183 days? So, you know, a little bit off topic here, but I think that's the, you know, that isn't all that objective either, potentially.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. And that's... ultimately, it's the overlap of the day's question with the legislative history, right? And we do see that situation a fair amount. You know, we just had a case that was resolved, I think, last year where the guy lived in Greenwich, quarter mile from the New York border. So like even when he was sitting at home, the cell phone was pinging New York. But he pulled out of his driveway. If he turned left, he was in New York State, right? So, geez, the closest dry cleaner, the closest pharmacy, you know, the place that they took the vet to get checked, all these things in New York State, but all that activity tied to Connecticut domicile. Meanwhile, he had an apartment in the city, right? City day count under 183. So that's an interesting sort of overlap here, which is, look, yeah, he's over 183 if you count days purely objectively, ensure the place in the city, it was a PPA for him. He used it all the time. But is that guy in the target class of taxpayers who were seeking to tax his taxes New York State residents? Yeah. And that was my argument to them, and they kind of laughed me out of the room.
Yeah, I think that I didn't really think about it much until now, but that argument has some additional legs just based on the language here too, about who we're really trying to tax.
Yeah, I think that's to me the most interesting question that's opened up by this decision. And if you read the decision when they talk about the legislative intent, it gets to this idea of like a taxpayer who maintains a voting residence elsewhere but, quote, insists on paying taxes to New York as a non-resident. Like it's very 1922.
It's very 1922 because these days, maybe Drew, you said this before, like they would just tax that guy as a domiciled taxpayer. They'd be like, screw you. You don't live in New Hampshire. You just vote there, you idiot. You're here 10 months a year. Like, you didn't need to change the law to tax that guy. You just needed to have a more aggressive interpretation of the domicile test, which, you know, starting in the early 1990s, like, they started to do that. And they, you know, there's lots of developed case law now around the domicile test. But that concept, you know, of why statutory residency was there in the first place didn't really ever catch up to that.
I think this is probably a good time to get to our parting thoughts. We've had a, you know, literally had a revelation about potential future legal analysis as to how to dispute these cases on this particular episode, which if that's not a reason to listen to the show, like, I don't know what is. We're groundbreaking legal analysis is happening in real time at this table. So thanks again to my guests. I'm just going to go around the table and ask everyone for any parting thoughts, if you have any, about OBIS or the future of the PPA prong of the statutory residency test. Emma, I'll start with you since you are to my left.
Thanks, Joe. So I guess my parting thoughts are, you know, I do wonder what the department's going to do after this. I think that while this is a really big victory, I question how many taxpayers are really going to benefit from this case. Like, as I do think it is a very small group of people that this applies to. It doesn't necessarily apply to, you know, all of our typical clients that come to us. But I do think it, you know, at least gives us an argument to help out a number of people.
Tim?
Can I get a little more philosophical?
Absolutely, you can.
Like, never give up. You know what I mean? Like, I you know, not about
Jim Valvano.
Yeah, exactly. Never, ever give up. Like, you know, I think as a group, like our SALT group, like comes up with good ideas sometimes. And I think this was one of them. And you just got to like keep pounding at it. You know, we're facing issues around the telecommuting rule now and how they're, you know, interpreting the convenience test. In the short term, it's like, man, I'm going to lose this case. But I mean, you just sort of like find a case and run with it and you can get it to the right answer. So this is, I love this sort of this saga because, you know, we started from the bottom. We got our butts kicked a couple times, but, you know, truth will win out, you know, so don't give up.
Love that. Drew?
I think the email that I sent after we saw that the decision was final was the PPA analysis is now a subjective inquiry. Bring on the audits, right? So my takeaway is kind of consistent with what Tim just said, which is this gives us lots of fuel to make creative arguments in the audit context where historically we've, you know, had difficulty, you know, sort of finding an avenue to get through to auditors. So that's kind of one. And then, you know, I think the other takeaway is what does New York State do with this, right? They have a history of reacting to things like this by going and changing the law, right? They did it with Sabatka. They've done it with other issues. They lose a case, they go and change the law. Do they do something like that, or do they just sort of do what they did post-GAED and change their guidelines and, you know, kind of aggressively enforce their view of what OBIS means? And I think that's kind of an open question, you know, for what this is going to look like for the next several years.
And for my parting thoughts, you know, you mentioned audits, but the precursor to any audit is good tax planning, or should be good tax planning. And I think this represents a great opportunity for what might be a narrow class of taxpayers, but taxpayers that are out there nonetheless to, you know, think about what their current situation is and try to put themselves in the best position should an audit arise in the future. And for those commuters who were afraid of purchasing a vacation home in New York in the past, you're presented with a new opportunity. But don't rush into it. You know, call a tax professional. Call the tax professionals at Hodgson Russ. Wink, wink. And, you know, I think that this is going to be an interesting road. This is a great win for taxpayers. We don't necessarily have any certainty where things will go from here, but there are a lot of potential routes. And I think that a lot of them could be quite beneficial to a certain group of people. So with that said, thank you to all three of you for joining me today. This was a great discussion. It's always nice to get around the table and discuss a big taxpayer win. I think it brings a nice lightheartedness to the conversation.
All right, great. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Until next time, tax fans, I've been Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans. The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.